Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
This program was sponsored by White Oak Pastures. The Harris family has lived and farmed White Oak Pastures for 145 years. They are committed to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. Their mission? We take care of the land and the herd, and they take care of us. For more information about their cattle and their farm, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
That was a message from our sponsor. This is Severin. This is Greenhorns Radio. And we are radio for young farmers, by young farmers. I'm joined today on the phone by Adam, who's coming from Southeast Arizona. Is that right?
That's right, yep. We're in Cochise County, Arizona, and about an hour east of Tucson.
Okay, so not usually are people thinking about what the farmers of the desert are experiencing. Those of us who live in places where the rain just falls and falls, and this year fell almost every day through the month of May. Could you explain a little bit, as you look out over the landscape there, what you see?
Yeah, we're near the San Pedro River, and which flows north from Mexico. And right now, looking out over the river, it's all cottonwoods that are dormant right now and mesquite trees that are also dormant. So the natural landscape looks pretty brown and gray this time of year. But we're warm enough generally to have a year-round growing season, at least for greens and such. So our fields are really green right now. We've got about 6 acres of pasture that our chickens are on, and we've got 6 acres of vegetables going also, and then an acre of garlic that's in right now. And it's mostly a green and greens and root vegetables that are growing this time of year for us.
And what has been the history there in the Sleepy Hollow world? What has been your journey getting to this point?
Sure, we started. There's actually four of us that own the farm together. It's my wife Debbie, and then our friend CJ and our friend Clay and myself. We all started the farm together. And before Clay had joined on, CJ, Debbie, and myself had started on about a quarter of an acre right outside of Tucson city limits. And we had eventually expanded that to just under an acre. And we were leasing land and doing primarily farmers markets and restaurant sales. And we're really hoping to make a little bit more of an impact on the local food scene here, just because it's Tucson's got close to 1 million people in the area, and it's really underserved as far as, local produce growers. So we got an opportunity to get a mortgage on 75 acres, which is where we are now. So we made that move in April of 2010, and we kind of, tried to transition from the small farm up to this farm, and we ran both farms for about 8 months at the same time until we closed the old one down and, shifted production 100% over to where we are now. So that was just, we ended the old farm December 22nd, I believe, of 2010. So we've been here just over a year full time. And there's been a little bit of a shift in weather for us because we're on this river valley. Our elevation is about 3,200 feet. And we moved from an elevation of about 2,800 feet in the Tucson Valley. And our nighttime temperatures changed by about 5 to 10 degrees. They got colder, which is beautiful in the summertime. But this time of year, we deal with, anywhere between 15 degree to 25 degree nights, starting in November and stretching all the way into April. And every once in a while, getting a dip into the single digits. And at the same time, the daytime temperatures warm up to I don't know, it's probably going to be 70, 75 today, which is great. But the difference between night and day is really interesting as far as how the plants react to that.
But you were like a tightly coiled, kitten who could grow up into a cat, and you weren't starting from nothing and trying to take on a huge project. Sounds like you had a business and a relationship.
Right.
Had practiced yourself into a good fitness level of farming and then had a good lucky strike. I just wanted you to reflect a little on that that moment fit in your farm and how you think you were ready for it and what was surprising about the stretch and like how you were able to move from something so small to something quite big. I mean, 6 acres of vegetables,
sure.
It ain't nothing to sniff at.
I think what gave us the confidence for that is that we had worked on a farm previous to starting our own. Clay and Debbie and myself had, and the three of us had worked together. And that farm was about the same size as where we are now. And they were running a good-sized CSA, but weren't really interested in staying with food production as much, and they were getting more into agricultural entertainment and doing festivals and tours and that kind of thing as their main business. And the three of us, and then Clay included when he joined on, our big interest was food production. And when we had started on the small farm, it was kind of all we could afford to do when we went to start on our own. We could only afford a few hundred dollars a month on land, and we couldn't afford equipment to get started on a bigger piece. So we started off on the small piece with the intent to eventually grow into something bigger. And that small piece offered us offered us an opportunity to get our names out there in the community and get our relationships with the restaurants and at the farmers market established. And we felt limited with that amount of land. Like, it was really hard to run a CSA just because of the limitations of the space and not being able to rotate crops and have enough successions going. And we knew, from our time at the farmers market when we were at the small farm, so many people were coming up and, when are you guys going to start a CSA or will you start a CSA? So there was a lot of interest in that. And we used the CSA. We started at the in May of 2010 was when we first started our CSA. So we had already purchased this property and used the financing of the CSA to make the transition happen. And again, I think, like what I said earlier, too, as far as there not being a whole lot of farms that serve the Tucson area, I mean, that gives us good confidence in the market, at least that there's a really wide-open market to sell our goods here. And there's a great demand for it, and just not enough people doing it yet.
I've heard that story before. So the appetite was there, and the interest was there, and you had this experience of money is like manure, where goes a long way, and too much at once isn't right, but a good load doesn't hurt. But here's a question I have. In your writings and in your descriptions of your project, you talk so much about being a productive permaculture site. And I thought, since mm-hmm. most people are associating permaculture with more home-scale land design, and it's not so frequent that you have a production-scale farm talking about permaculture principles, maybe you could explain a little bit more about how you walked into that permaculture work.
And we look at that on the permaculture and on the community level, largely. We've seen that there's a void in our community for fresh food that's sourced, within a close distance, and then also on the design of our on the farm. And the goal here for us is to close the system, meaning that like our nutrient cycle and our feed cycle for our animals and for the plants. So we run chickens, dairy goats, and they're for meat, dairy, eggs, meat from the chicken also. And, the hope here is that we have enough land to eventually be able to grow enough grain that, to supplement the chickens, above the pasture, and enough hay for the goats to where we can, kind of keep all of our feed homegrown, and then also in that sense have our nutrients between our cover crops and our animals be solely farm-raised, also to where we can get off of. Like right now we use bag guano as a fertilizer. And we do use manure from some of our neighboring farms. And, you know, on a larger scale, that's kind of, that's the hope. That's the dream here is to get to that point.
And how long do you give yourself for that dream? Because this kind of long-term thinking is a major part of permaculture and importing materials and capitalizing and setting up systems that over the long run will be self-sustaining. You just reflect a little on, because many people also don't even know what the principles are. You don't have to go through them all, but like, why do you have those goals?
Our hope there is within 10 years, 10 to 15 years has kind of been, you know, where we could be, doing a small-scale grain operation and being able to feed the animals. And you may have to scale back or scale up our animals also to find the appropriate quantity there, because we really haven't found that with, we don't know our potentials or our limits here necessarily as far as production. Being that we're in the desert, you know, most of our irrigation is groundwater. We can't really rely on rain out here on a production farm. Most of our rains come in the summertime in the monsoon season, and on a good year we'll get a little bit of winter rain also, but our average rainfall is only 12 inches a year out here. So, you know, using the drip, it works out to about $1,500 to $2,000 an acre for us to, you know, between parts and installation of the drip irrigation system. And so that's a big limiter for us, just financially, to getting more land under cultivation. So that's one of the big hurdles as far as getting more grain and more pasture going.
You can't even grow grains without irrigation.
Right, no. No,
oh,
I mean, there's some really short season stuff you could do. Amaranth is one that you could grow with the monsoon rains.
I know that chickens love amaranth.
They do. Yeah, they do. They do. And we usually graze them on that, because if we get a wild, you know, amaranth field come up with the monsoon rains, it's great for grazing. The wild amaranth we have here, though, is also a pain as far as being a weed in the gardens. So we try and have that knocked down before it seeds, too. So we can never use it as a grain.
Well, the weeds of today are the crops of tomorrow. Who knows? Who knows where we'll go?
Yeah.
So Tucson, from what I understand, is emerging, and there's a lot of interest in new energy, and the local food scene is just popping along. And there's also, in the permaculture framework and in the Tucson experience, particularly a strong emphasis on wild foods. Could you reflect maybe a little on your farm, the Zone 7 situation, and what's going on in the Sonoran wild food community?
Sure. Our biggest one here is the mesquite tree. It's, you know, one of the biggest. And that's a leguminous tree that's in the acacia family, and it has these great yellow pods. We get two crops a year of those pods, and they're a really high protein seed and pod. And for human consumption, we usually run those through a hammer mill, and come out with what we call mesquite flour, and that usually gets mixed in by people with, you know, for pancakes or breads, and it gets mixed with a wheat flour. It doesn't have a gluten in it to be able to bind by itself, but it's a really sweet, and it almost tastes like malt. It's a really, really nice, nice food, and it actually is a really good animal food also. We have, in our area, there's spotty patches of saguaro cactus out here, which give off a really nice fruit in the summertime. If we've had enough winter and spring rain, it'll put off if you've ever had dragon fruit or like a pitaya fruit, it's real similar to that, and it's in the same family. We also have nopal, the prickly pear, which is, you can use the pads for that, you know, fried or grilled. And then it also bears fruits. And then we have choya out here, which is another cactus that has little buds on it. And the most popular thing for that is to pickle it, or at least what we like to do is pickle it. And then it's almost like pickled okra. It has a little bit of gelatinous substance to it, and it's pretty tasty. And then there's, you know, as you get closer to Tucson, more like the Zone 9 area, there's ironwood trees, which also have a bean on them. That's edible, and you can eat them in the green stage, like peas. And the Palo Verde trees, which will, I've seen them out here a little bit, but they don't seem to grow native out here where we are, but more in like the Zone 8, Zone 9. The Palo Verde trees also have a really nice bean on them. Beyond that, we have, I believe there's 13 different species of wolfberries that are native in the Sonoran Desert. And those are really popular. Those are like the goji berries that are really popular in the like the health food scene. But we've got our own, you know, native varieties out here, which is really wonderful. And then we have, you know, this time of year, we've got globe mallow and wild mustard. And in the summertime, we get a wild purslane and a, you know, wild amaranth that are not necessarily native, but really nice kind of wild greens.
Well, and that's, I guess, kind of the question. It starts to become, you know, in a place where I wouldn't say traditional, I would say commercial production agriculture, you know, present some challenges in terms of having sufficient water to grow the kinds of crops that those of us with a European background are interested and used to eating. And then being at the right. same time surrounded by this tremendously abundant environment. What does it make you feel as a farmer, in the, as you're pointing ahead, like you're talking about feeding your own chickens and having a self-sustaining farm organism? Like, what's the kind of fringe vanguardy thinking in terms of the kind of farming that's going to make more sense in the coming decades down there?
I think for the first step that we see is to bring more food production, be it conventional or, you know, traditional farm methods with irrigation and with, you know, European and cultivated crops, and getting people first to get more into at least a locally based diet. And I think culturally the foodways have to shift for, you know, for people to appreciate the native foods and to shift over to eating that. And I think, you know, it might not be in my lifetime, but I would hope that, you know, at some point that's where, you know, we start to appreciate these things a little bit more and focus on our native foods a little bit more. But I kind of see like what we're doing here at our farm is more like a step in that direction. And by no means kind of the answer to our problems here in this region. But I do think that, you know, and we do have to, so in that sense, you know, we do have to kind of pump groundwater for the time being and grow just to make that shift. And mostly because people are just used to, and this goes, you know, really for the whole country, we're all used to being able to go into the grocery store and get anything at any time of the year. So until we can, you know, first see the
eyes on the prize.
Connectedness there between. Oh, what's that?
I said eyes on the prize, baby steps. Here we go.
Yeah, you know. that's where we
baby
get
step.
The sustainable thing is a big buzzword, and that's what we, you know, we're always telling people we're not sustainable. For that sake, in the long term, even what we're doing, you know, we feel like we're doing pretty good as far as agriculture goes, but in our region, long term, what we're doing really isn't sustainable. And it does have to be a shift back toward more indigenous foods and wild foods.
Well, we better recruit some more people to get involved, I'd say. Are there young ones in the hopper down there? Any other cool things going that we should talk about?
There's a few organizations that are starting. What's that?
No, keep talking. You're on the right track.
Okay.
There's a few organizations.
There are a few organizations that are in the efforts of training, for the time, like young farmers and you know, and there's a lot more interest just in general out here with the native foods scene, and with you know, backyard gardening is blowing up. And like you said, you know, the local food scene is just kind of popping here right now. We have there's a food bank in Tucson that has a department called the Community Food Resource Center to it, and they run a small training farm, and they run a program called the Youth Apprenticeship Program there that's trying to get young folks introduced to agriculture, and mostly youth that don't necessarily have an agricultural background but just have some bit of an interest in it, and tying that in with school gardens and home gardens with the youth also. And our farm, Sleeping Frog, is teaming up with another farm, Walking Jay, which is also in our area. They're south of Tucson. And we're trying to put together an educational, it's formed now, the nonprofit is there, but we're still kind of in the building stages of actually organizing it and getting financing going for that also. But the hope with FERN is what we're calling it, the Farm Education Resource Network, is to offer vocational training on small scale polycultural farms, to where, you know, in an effort, I guess, to give some alternative to what's going on with the university trainings here, because our state is known for cotton and cattle, and, you know, citrus is also really big out here, but a lot of large scale monocrop. And there's not a whole lot of alternative offered in this area at the high school or the university level for this kind of agriculture that we're practicing. So we're hoping to get the few small farmers there are in the area kind of into a teaching position. And the hope there is to be able to compensate the farmers for their time teaching. And, you know, we kind of see that as the only way to really get, you know, more youth kind of on real hands-on, on-the-job kind of training.
Wow, I'm impressed. I'm thankful. That sounds so right. That's like the craft programs that we have. It's a consortium methodology where different farms partner mm-hmm. together so that the apprentices get a fuller learning experience.
Right.
And what's your time frame? When should people start calling you for applying? When do people start calling you to apply?
Hopefully within 2013? The next 3 months here. We just finished a lot of the, I don't know, we're still on the paperwork end of things. And, for both farms.
It's just terrible.
We're trying to take as much time as we can to get away to work on it.
I think people are going to be flooding towards you, and are going to be walking into a much better set of opportunities these days than there were even 5 years ago for young farmers. Maybe mm-hmm. you could, as a kind of a final point, explain how you found farming and what, you know, because you've moved from the small, you were apprenticing, you had the small farm, now you have the big farm, now you're getting involved in institution making and education. What was the first spark, and how do you see the welcoming that you're about to do, with your institution, kind of in that history, in the personal history?
Sure. I was a little more background on me. I was born in a small town in Illinois called Sterling, Illinois, and it's about 100 miles west of Chicago, and it's a big corn and soybean town. And so I grew up, I grew up in Tucson, but I'd spend my summers back there a lot of times. And that was my understanding of agriculture, was you know, just this large thousands of acres of one crop, be it corn or soybean, as far as you could see. And that was a huge turnoff to me. So when I was young, and at that point, all the truck farms near my hometown had pretty much gone away. But I saw that growing up, and I thought the last thing I wanted to do was be involved in agriculture, because it seemed pretty boring. And kind of the hook for me is when I was 18 and, you know, started, I was out living on my own, And living with roommates, you know, we got into cooking for ourselves a lot more than we ever had. And at that point, started seeking out, you know, kind of fresher food and tastier food. And it was just like something, you know, something sparked for me to just follow the food to where it came from. And I got into working out. I eventually worked at a little co-op or a little health food store in the produce department. That was one more step closer. And then from there, I was able to meet some farmers in Arizona and California and go out to their farms, visit the farms. And it was, you know, in a sense, just like one step, one leading to the other. And then I decided to do the apprenticeships or the internships and the volunteering on farms, and I kind of got the bug for it. And, that just really developed into a passion for me. And, I think one of the big things that keeps us going, I think the four of us that own this place together, we all share that passion for food production and for healthier food than maybe what we grew up with. And it's also, of all the different jobs that I've done, it's something I can go home at the end of the day and feel proud for the day's work that I did. Have some sense of purpose, which is, that's huge, I think, as far as keeping me going in whatever your work is.
Well, it's step by step. Feels like we could make a quicker set of steps for people who are tuning in to get inoculated and catch the bug, but then also be able to actualize more efficiently. I mean, right. I don't know if efficiently
that's
is the word,
hope,
but
I think now, and I think that's happening. It does seem like it's happening across the country where more opportunities are coming available, which is great. That's something that the more we can make that available. I don't know. The hard thing still remains, I think, with the youth is financial viability as far as a career. And, that's something where we're trying to ask our local communities to step up. And that's where we found the CSA model to really be the strongest in that kind of a thing. So if we can get more people in the community, understand that not everybody's going to want to farm, but for those that don't want to farm but they still want to eat, if they can get out and support, their existing farmers and their prospective farmers through that route, CSA just serves as great financing. And, that people are going to need some bit of financial security to do this.
Yeah, there's the bottom line. And then similarly in the youth department, to get an expectation within early in your career that if you're going to make this work, you're going to have to, keep pretty disciplined and pretty focused and figure out if you can do a little off-farm income and learn how to live for cheap and, survive the entry period, the startup period. So getting the training on the community level of the expectation and then getting the training of the young farmers that they know what to expect and how to prepare to be a little bit broke for a little while. Or very
right.
broke for a little while.
Yeah.
Any last tagging of resources that you wanted to do as a conclusion of, especially in the realm of permaculture and productive farms or institutions that really help you along your way?
We have a great permaculture network. Yeah, there's a great permaculture network here in southern Arizona called the Sonoran Permaculture Guild, and it's specifically for our dry land and desert environment. And like I said, the network, the Farm Education Resource Network, or FERN, and we are online, and I'm terrible here, I believe it's fern.org, but if you Google it, that'll be up again here soon.
Well, there you go, Tucson on the rise. Thank you so kindly, Adam, for joining us. This has been Greenhorns Radio.
You're welcome.
I'm
thank
Severin.
You, Severin. And thank you
thank
guys
you.
For doing what you do. Yeah.
Our pleasure.
Way back up in the world.
And this is Heritage Radio.
Talk to you later.
We're happy. Talk to you later. This is Heritage Radio.
My papa was a great old man. I can see him with a shovel in his hand.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.